from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There was a time when marching on the Mall meant politics, high rhetoric, and hands across the nation's capital from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial. Now it means the shopping mall. America has gone from citizen nation to consumer nation, and there's no turning back. Tonight, On Point, a democracy of dollars, of goods, citizenship, consumption, and the consumer republic. We begin with a look inside the crackling tension with North Korea. Yesterday, CIA Director George Tenet said that the world is in a new era of nuclear proliferation and that North Korea has a ballistic missile capable of reaching the western United States. We wanted to know more than the headline. Clay Moltz is Associate Director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. I asked him to spell out whether California is in fact vulnerable to a nuclear attack by North Korea.
There's several issues here. First of all, we don't know if North Korea does have a nuclear weapon. We know they have separated plutonium, but they have not tested a nuclear weapon, and we're not clear whether or not they have any sort of weapon design that would work. At the same time, in terms of the missiles, we have overflights apparently that have indicated that, and in fact we have these even from the mid to late 1990s, that they were doing testing of the engines for the Taepodong 2 missile. These are possibly of intercontinental range, but what's not clear is whether the North Koreans are capable of taking these engines and then mating them with a rocket body that will fly efficiently and will undergo the aerodynamic stresses of launch and then a reentry to deliver a payload effectively. This is still very much in question.
So there are really two issues here. It's an alarming headline to see that North Korea has missiles that can reach California because of all the talk about nuclear weapons in North Korea. But A, as you point out, whether or not they actually have those weapons yet and the dimensions and the utility of those weapons are still unknown. And B, there's the missile itself. Now, on the missile front, how far has North Korea been able to launch and fly missiles at this point?
North Korea's last missile test was in August of 1998. This was a Taepodong 1 missile, and it was a three-stage missile that flew 1,600 kilometers across Japan and landed in the ocean. The missile was a three-stage missile, as I said, two liquid stages mm-hmm. that were both successful, and then a third, smaller, solid-fuel stage that failed. Again, based on the experience of the North Korean program to date, it's very difficult to say whether this mock-up that they have apparently of the Taepodong 2 would actually work. It's also, I think, fair to say that these are, again, prototypes. And so even if North Korea were able to launch a test in the next several weeks, let's say, they would not necessarily be able to mass produce this weapon. In fact, it's very unlikely that they would be able to do so. Another point to keep in mind is the question of the accuracy of this missile. North Korean missiles to date seem to have an accuracy of no more than several thousands of meters. And for a missile of the range that we're talking about, which would be somewhere in the order of 6,000 miles, it could be off in terms of direction by as many as tens or twenties of miles. Again, would be only effective as some sort of terror weapon. And at the same time, it would probably have as high a chance of landing in the ocean.
But I guess everyone's paying attention because North Korea has indicated that it's developing nuclear weapons, has spoken of a preemptive attack. Nobody wants to get anywhere near this zone. But if you were a U.S. military planner at this point, would you feel you had to take into account a West Coast United States vulnerability to North Korean missile attack?
Yes, I certainly would if I were a military planner. But the way you go about this most likely would be to monitor very carefully the test sites. These are liquid fuel missiles, and any of these missiles will have to be tanked up with fuel in advance of a launch. So we will have at least several hours of warning before any sort of missile test or any missile that was to be used with an actual warhead.
Because satellites would observe that fueling process?
That's correct.
Even if done at night?
Yes. In addition, we have means of monitoring the movement in and out of these sites. Trucks, for example, moving a missile is not a trivial matter. They're quite large, and it would take some time to get it to one of the test sites. So it's not something that is easy to hide.
So, Klimoltz, we're trying to keep a sense of balance in processing all the headlines that we see coming out lately. What I hear you saying is this is something that would hypothetically be possible but sounds quite unlikely at this point.
I think it's unlikely. At the same time, I don't think that we should just take this lying down. I think we need to engage the problem. In other words, we need to begin to talk to the North Koreans about this, suggest why it concerns us, and also find out what kinds of arrangements we might be able to make to see that this never is launched. Because in my mind, the more tests that they're able to conduct without an agreement on a test ban, the more likely they are going to gain new information about how to perfect this missile. Similarly, in the nuclear area, I think we want to try to freeze and to shut down that program, get the inspectors back in, so that North Korea does not move further along the line of developing nuclear weapons.
And I guess the other question is, for North Korea, missiles have been an important export product. Is it possible that North Koreans are now or might soon, in the foreseeable future, be selling these long-range missiles to third parties who might use them?
Yes, I think this is a very serious concern. And in fact, there's good evidence to suggest that the launch of the Taepodong-1 missile was possibly meant for foreign clients to show them that they could launch a missile of this greater range than their previous Nodong tests. Again, they do rely as much as 25% to 50%, depending on the year, on missile exports for hard currency. So it is a serious industry in their country. Again, this is why the Clinton administration had tried to reach an agreement with North Korea to shut that whole program down, but they were not able to do so before they left office.
It's an alarming prospect to imagine intercontinental missiles popping up in countries all over the world. How do we put this genie back in the bottle, Klimoltz?
I think we have to look through some innovative solutions. The good news, at least in regards to North Korea, is that they have indicated in a variety of statements that they are willing to talk about this. They're willing to consider some sort of bargain in order to gain food aid, economic assistance, and also some things that are more basic, diplomatic relations with the United States, a pledge that we would not invade them unless we were attacked. Those kinds of pledges are relatively cheap for the United States to deliver, and yet they might provide the kind of security guarantee that would allow North Korea to come to an agreement regarding trading missiles for food aid, which I think would be very much in our interest.
Klimoltz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Klimoltz is Associate Director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He spoke with us from Monterey, California. In the aftermath of September 11th, American citizens looked to the president and asked, "What is expected of us?" This, in part, is how he answered.
Do your business around the country. Fly and enjoy America's great destination spots. Get down to Disney World in Florida. Take your families and enjoy life the way we want it to be enjoyed.
President Bush on September 27, 2001 in Chicago. Go about the business of America, he said. Spend, shop, travel, consume. Your patriotic duty is to purchase. It was a defining moment for President Bush, but for our guest tonight, Harvard historian Elizabeth Cohen, it was also a keen illustration of the transformation of America from a nation of citizens to a nation of consumers. In the decades since World War II, America has turned into a democracy of dollars. Consumers and consumption have remade American politics, culture, and society in such profound ways, Cohen says, that returning to the Shangri-La of our citizen forebears is now impossible. So, is it? Do you feel like a consumer first and a citizen second? Is there even a difference anymore? Has America's democracy become the consumer republic? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio now is Elizabeth Cohen, professor of American Studies at Harvard and author of the new book, A Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Postwar America. Good evening. Great to have you, Elizabeth Cohen.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Professor Cohen.
Elizabeth Cohen, you lay out a big picture here, a big sweep in time and also in transformation, as you describe it. But we're now also pickled in this consumer society that you describe. that I'm not sure we can really see it any other way. I wonder if you could paint a picture for us, a little bit of before and after. You describe sort of the last 70 years of the 20th century as a time of America wading deeper and deeper into this consumer identity, the consumer mentality, consumer politics. So as opposed to what came before? What's the change? How would you describe the before and after pictures?
Okay, we'll try to do that pretty briefly. In the 19th century, when people thought about what a citizen was, they sought an identity that conveyed independence. And independence meant being an independent producer and not dependent on anybody who was going to in some way distort your sort of political allegiances and so forth. And that really
an
was...
an independent producer. So my ranch, my workshop...
Absolutely.
My output.
Exactly. And that's really the 19th century story. And I see that starting to change in the beginning of the 20th century, in the progressive era, as the progressives sort of look around for a social group to mobilize to represent the public interest. Consumers are a good candidate. It's broad-reaching. Lots of people are consumers. It's a way to kind of take a stand and mobilize people against, increasingly smart, rich interests, industrial mm-hmm. interests. Mm-hmm. And so there's the beginning in the progressive era of kind of mobilizing consumers as a way of asserting the people's interests.
And when you say consumers, or when they thought of it was as we are people who buy things?
Yes, to some extent, but much more at that time. This is the era when the FDA gets, the FTC, all these agencies get set up.
Mm-hmm. A sense to protect that, consumers.
Exactly, from big corporations.
So kind this of is government the, intervention or moderation of the process of buying and selling.
Basically a way of putting some limits on the sort of corporate power that was expanding in the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But it's not, it's utilities that are owned by the people, supposedly, but it's limited, very limited. The agencies that get set up are not at all sort of powerful. And then in the 1920s, there's a kind of retreat from a progressive notion, and I mean progressive with a big P.
Because it was boom times and it was all about the market.
Exactly. And it was sort of a return to, sort of a pretty market-oriented way of thinking about the economy, but that there was the expectation that everybody would benefit because there were more things to buy and there was a lot of money around. And it's
we're going to come back to the Depression, but I want you then to bring it right up to date and then the extreme of consumerism that we're at now and compare that profile materially and politically with that 19th century American you described.
Good question. I think that what happens is that I can't sort of not talk about the historical aspect of it, but I see particularly in the post-World War II period the merger of the citizen and the consumer and the increasing importance of being a consumer to one's sense of being a citizen. And so these become roles that are very difficult to separate. And they have, but there's not just one implication. There's actually a sort of a positive and a negative side, and I really see both of those.
We're going to come back and talk in a lot of detail about that, Liz Cohen, and it's a fascinating subject. I want to understand viscerally the difference between 19th century, Homo sapien American and 21st or 20th century on this consumer vector. Jack Beatty, this is rich territory, American citizens going from frontier independent citizens to consuming citizens.
Yes, and discovering something, the limitlessness of desire. There's a great sentence in Galbraith's Affluent Society, quote, "The concept of satiation has very little standing in economics." And, of course, it's that, the insatiability of desire that is the wheel driving the consumer economy, and of course it's one of the reasons why consumerism in many people's minds connotes unhappiness, a kind of systematic deprival of stability in life and of making one's wants serve one's real needs as opposed to relieving yourself somehow by buying things.
And yet, isn't the nation there in part to speak to those desires and wants of its citizens? We're talking tonight about the consumer republic. How has the consumer society shaped the American democracy? Does your American citizenship mean more than being an American consumer? Do you spend more time voting or shopping? Do you now vote with your wallet? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Consumer Republic with Elizabeth Cohen, author of A Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Post-War America. You are welcome to join the conversation. Is shopping the new patriotism? Are your most important moments economic or political today? And what does citizenship mean to you if consumption isn't what you have in mind? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Elizabeth Cohen, you write that in the aftermath of World War II, a fundamental shift in America's economy, politics, and culture took place with major consequences for how Americans made a living, where they lived, how they interacted with others, how and what they consumed, what they expected of government, much else. And you draw all of this transformation around consumption, around consumerism. Why? How? What's the transformation?
Well, let's sort of go back and think about it. It's 1945. We've been through 15 years of crisis of different kinds. First, 10 years of a terrible depression, 5 years of war, most of which we are engaged in. And coming out of that wartime, there's tremendous anxiety. What's going to happen? After World War I, there was a terrible recession, a worry we'd go back into the Great Depression. We're going to have millions of men coming back, mostly men, not all men, but mostly men coming back from war. And how are we going to recover? And there's a lot of debate around that. And what I find is that there's a kind of consensus that develops from an amazing range of people, pretty conservative business people, pretty free market oriented, more moderate sort of New Deal businessmen types, the labor movement, around the importance of purchasing power, of mass consumption, getting us out of this the wartime economy and launched into, a recovery and a prosperity. And then it's not just an economic solution that they see. They see that this is going to be the route to delivering many long-sought American ideals of greater equality and democracy.
So they don't see it in tension with democracy. They see it as a vehicle
Absolutely.
For democracy.
Absolutely. We're going to create a society of more fully participating economically, people who are going to be more middle class. They're going to be living next to neighbors in their own homes, driving their own cars.
Because they have the physical means to be comfortable and alert and engaged, they will be better citizens.
They'll be on an equal footing with each other. And they will be, when they consume, and this is really key, the message that came across to Americans was that consuming wasn't something that was all about self-indulgence. When you did it, you also benefited the nation. And there were just numerous, invocations of that.
So what's the transformation here? Are you describing a transformation from a housewife churning butter from the cow that she milked to butter toast, a bread that she baked, to a housewife buying her butter, buying her bread? Is that the transformation? What's the political transformation? What's the attitudinal transformation that comes along? We all saw the explosion in consumerism. What did it matter? What does it mean?
Well, first of all, let's just that transition from churning your butter is something that happened, in the 18th century, in the early 19th century. That was long. People had been buying things for most of the 20th century.
But you're not pointing to that moment as the moment of the surge of consumerism. So
what's
the distinction?
Different here is the feeling that the nation itself is going to benefit, the health of the economy and the nation as a whole is going to depend on people being consumers.
So before it was just a kind of natural give and take, buy and sell. Now it's open up the afterburners
right.
And buy, because this is our way forward.
And that is something that really happens in the 1930s, that shift. That as we build a strong national state for the first time in the 1930s, and people...
That is a government that's really, really nationwide engaged.
Right, exactly. There's a lot of anxiety about that. And one of the ways that Roosevelt and the New Dealers dealt with that worry that how would there be a voice for the public interest was that they tried to recognize consumers as a way of of articulating and responding to the public, the general public. So that had started to happen in the 1930s.
So they step on the consumption accelerator, on the consumerism identity, and the consequences are?
The consequences of society where, you know, when you buy things, you're doing it not just for yourself, but for the good of the society. And that you and if you're a sort of a framer of this consumer's republic, you look to the market, to the private marketplace, to solve a lot of problems that the society has. You look to the we have a terrible housing crisis when we come out of these 15 years. The solution that's promoted is the private real estate market. What we're going to do is deliver in, you know, block after block of single family detached homes in these booming suburbs, the private house. That will be the solution to our housing problem. So that it's looking to the private marketplace and assuming that it can solve larger social problems.
So it's the private house for a roof over here, the private car for transportation,
right.
the private washing machine, not the laundromat.
And, you know, if we look at suburbs as kind of the centerpiece of a lot of this kind of post-war society, it's also replacing a legally privately owned place, the shopping mall, for downtown, which was, you know, a public square,
so
a public
instead of
place.
A civic terrain, you have a privately owned, kind of fragmented out along the beltway terrain.
Again, a place, and early shopping centers defended themselves this way as the center of this this post-war world, but it is one that is purely devoted to mass consumption.
So what's your judgment then, Liz Cohen? FDR and others said this will be a way to empower our citizens, to fuel democracy. Did it work? Did this enhance American citizens as citizens of a republic or diminish them?
Well, I actually see sort of two trends. There's a sort of a good side of the story and a bad side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The positive side is that in linking citizenship and consumption, we did give a vehicle to many sort of disempowered groups. And here I'm talking specifically about African Americans, about women who in many ways weren't sort of equal participants in politics. We gave them a vehicle to sort of make a larger claim on the society.
That they could buy palm olive?
Well, let me explain. The linkage that gets made, particularly in the context of World War II, between being a good citizen and being a good consumer, was experienced by African Americans as a great frustration because it was they took the message and they couldn't participate fully.
Mm-hmm.
If they were wearing a military uniform when they left the base, they had to ride in the back of the bus to go to the local town. They couldn't eat in a restaurant. They couldn't try on clothes in a department store. They couldn't stay at a hotel. It was a tremendous affront. And blacks came out of World War II. Very committed to basically the civil rights movement, which begins actually in the 1940s and 1950s in the North, not in the South as we associate it with the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 and the lunch counter cities of 1960, but really in northern cities around the struggle for access to public accommodations, which at this point are commercial spaces.
And so to buy things, to be in the consuming zone.
Exactly. They sort of turn the free market, say, okay, if it's a free market, we should have access to it. It should be free and open.
And that becomes the new litmus test. Citizen Beatty, I buy, therefore I am the American citizen?
That seems to be the motto, isn't it, huh? You know, this idea of purchasing power as countercyclical. This is the way you get out of depressions. You get people buying. It had a public face too, but not much came of that. And maybe Professor Cohen can talk about that. I mean, the Employment Act of 1946. The idea was that if unemployment reaches a certain level, well, you won't just count on people to buy because they're going to be out of work. What you're going to do is bring back something like public works. You're going to have people like a WPA as a kind of permanent feature of our counter-cyclical, counter-business cycle pump priming. And that idea of, you know, a sort of public response to slowing, you know, lapsing demand, that goes by the boards. And so does something else in 1946. You know, you get the right to organize in the 30s, and then in 1946 you get the Taft-Hartley Act, which pulls back a lot of the rights that unions had just won. And of course, that was a, the union, collective bargaining, was a basic sort of foundation of American, of the American consumer. You couldn't purchase unless you had money. And the way to get money as a worker was to have collective bargaining. So these two props of the public side of consumption, if you will, the public side of forcing of counter-cyclical spending, these went by the boards, and we got the kind of private solution, if you will, buy, buy, buy.
But what about the quality of American citizenship, Jack? Enhanced, you know, for the next 20, 30 years after the war, it was a golden economic period. Not every year, but overall, American houses filled up with things.
They did. But you know, all through this period, writers like David Reisman in an essay called Abundance for What, people like John Kenneth Galbraith, even Vance Packard in a book about advertising, they were saying, well, yes, it's important to consume, and that's fine, but, you know, there's a whole want creation industry out there, which we're plugged into, that is making us want things and buy things that we don't really need, and it's sort of distracting us humanly from our centers. And that this whole want creation industry, which is what drives it, adds an element here of exploitation, if you will, to the free choice that the consumer is supposed to exercise. It's less free, really, than kind of what? Weighted.
We're boring into the Consumer Republic tonight and asking you where you stand. Do your political leaders treat you today as a consumer or a citizen, or have the two become one? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Aaron's calling. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It strikes me that an inevitable conclusion of having a more consumer-oriented nation is that our politicians are treated more as a viable commodity, if you will, in addition to everything else being more viable. And I'm curious to know what Professor Cohen thinks about whether or not our politicians are more or less accessible to the general public as a result of that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Aaron. Liz Cohen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the impact of all this on politics. Certainly, there is much more commercialization of politics, the application of lots of marketing and advertising technique to politics, the need to then have money and, you know, skillful media advisors to be a successful politician. But I talk about another thing also that I think is important here in this conversation, and this is the negative story that I didn't get to talk about before, and that is that what I see happening is the development of marketing techniques, and particularly one shift that I think is critical, a shift from mass marketing to segmented marketing.
And it happened in the 70s, you say, when the economy just fell to pieces and they had to find a niche to sell things
to. It starts to happen actually in the late 1950s. It takes off in the 1960s, and then, you know, it's there forever. What happens is that mass marketers and advertisers start to recognize that the big profits aren't going to continually be made in selling to the mass. That's going to be saturated. The profits are going to come in figuring out segments of the population and how to sell different products, or in some cases the same product, packaged different ways. So what happens, and you can really see this happen, is that politicians, their managers, campaigns, and so forth, start to pick up these techniques of the marketers and the advertisers.
And soon life is segmented as well.
Absolutely. And so we slice and dice the electorate in the same way that marketers are doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dave's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to voice a personal situation that I'm caught in at this moment. I work for a company here in the Erie area that built energy construction, heat recovery steam generators.
All right.
This company was dramatically affected by the downfall of Enron to the point that we lost 135 of the 235 people that were with our company. Yes, since last March. What my point here is that not only am I desperately looking for a job with two
Good luck, my friend. Good luck.
Yes, thank you. I'm working every day with two children in college. But right at this point, I feel like neither a consumer or a recognized citizen.
So in a sense, when you lose your economic means in the consumer society, you're neither consumer nor citizen.
That's correct. You're just a survivor. You're just making it from week to week and month to month to get by. And what bothers me is that I see very little that's concrete in by the government that's addressing the plight of people like myself, college-educated, after college, attained certifications as a professional procurement person.
But, Dave, you can still go to the voting booth. Isn't that still the citizen piece here?
Oh, yes, and I do go to the voting booth. But in the meantime, of course, I have tuitions for two students to pay. I'm seeking a job. And what I'm missing here is that it seems that there are no people out on the streets protesting for jobs, trying to bring our own situations to light. Mm-hmm. So perhaps something will be done to give us some type of attention. I know the government can't just create jobs, but it obviously doesn't seem like much is being done at this moment with the Iraq situation.
Dave, you paint a very vivid picture, and you give us a great reality check here. Thank you for your call. Elizabeth Cohen. Dave, at this moment, is not much of a consumer. He doesn't really feel like an empowered citizen. He's missing some political music here that mm-hmm. would make him feel empowered even when there's not a paycheck coming so regularly.
Now, I think he's really onto something, and that is that, you know, the worker is sort of disappearing in this story. You know, we're talking about purchasing power. We're concerned that there are enough dollars being spent to prop up the economy. But in contrast to that 19th century story we started with, we're not really fixated on, you know, whether people are working and seeing the importance of them and their jobs to the viability of the nation. We're concerned much more with whether people are spending enough.
And but we obsess about the unemployment rate. President Bush is always talking about creating jobs. Would it really have been that different 100 years ago?
Well, no, I mean, it's true we worry about the unemployment rate, but we worry about that often because of its effect on the stock market and on sort of the larger financial markets. You know, there's not a lot of attention to and the unions still try to make this argument all the time. They basically are going, they still talk in the language of this earlier post-war period and say, how are we going to have a viable economy if we have unemployed people who don't have money to spend? You know, they still talk in that language, and that's an argument often for keeping jobs at home, not exporting them abroad and so forth. But it's not an argument that has a lot of resonance.
Jack Beatty, is a consumer society necessarily somehow at odds with a producer society, a nation of production? I don't see why it would be.
Well, you know, that to me is one of the striking developments since the 1970s, that Americans increasingly have sacrificed our role as producers for our role as consumers. That's exactly what the $400 billion trade deficit means. We are buying foreign goods without any thought that we are essentially exporting American jobs. To get the lowest price or to get what we want, we have sort of dissevered the relation between what we do for a living and what we buy. And, you know, this can't go on forever. And there's something fundamentally distortive about it. And I think really, too, it's a way in which consumerism has tended to weaken our national sense of solidarity. I mean, when you go and buy that Japanese car, you're buying a Japanese car.
It's a global village, Jack. You're buying it from the guy just around the village corner.
Yeah, but tell it to the folks in Detroit. I mean, that's not how Americans used to think. I'm just saying big change.
I hear you loud and clear. We're talking tonight about the Consumer Republic with Elizabeth Cohen, author of A Consumer's Republic. You can join the conversation. Has the consumer society upstaged the American democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the consumer citizen with Elizabeth Cohen, author of A Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Post-War America. You are welcome to join the conversation. Can you imagine an America where citizenship trumped consumerism? What would that look like? Can a consumer republic be noble, moral, idealistic? Is consumerism now at the heart of American democracy? And can we, should we, project that democracy to the world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Elizabeth Cohen, just before the break, Jack Beatty was talking about consumption and production, and he sees not enough emphasis and support on the production side. Are we leaving the worker out of this equation somehow?
Yeah, I wanted to add to Jack's point, which I thought was a good one, by saying that this isn't just, you know, full blown as, you know, in the 1940s and 50s as we're experiencing today, it evolves. And at first, when the focus is really on the mass, there's the sense that it matters that workers have money to spend and that we build a really mass middle-class market. I think what we're seeing, and Jack pointed to the mid-1970s as a critical turning point, and I would agree with him, and it sort of increased over the 80s and 90s, and it's with us, you know, very powerfully today, a sense that it almost doesn't matter that everybody has money to contribute. We just need that spending. And so, you know, okay, if it's the wealthy, the very small percentage of people with money to spend, and other people will just work in sort of low-paying service jobs.
So you're saying consumerism no longer depends on mass consumption.
Yeah, I think there's a really critical shift in that way. And we saw great inequalities develop, particularly over the 1990s, and they're very much with us now.
But does consumerism then rob somehow the mass of the voice to speak to this dynamic?
Or
is it still empowering in the way you describe FDR and that generation hoping, imagining it would?
Well, I think we've lost, you know, the earlier vision of it. It had flaws. I'm not, you know, endorsing it totally. But we did see that it was important to bring everybody into this consumer's republic and that its viability depended on fairly large participation.
And now consumer
and now,
get lost.
Yeah, and that, well, now, you know, what matters most is that there be a lot of dollars spent, but not so much that everybody have dollars to spend.
Ardell is calling from Decorah, Wisconsin. Hi, Ardell. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling to voice some concern about the mainstream media depiction of those of us who choose not to consume without responsibility.
Consume without responsibility. Therefore, you're describing yourself as a conscientious consumer, Ardell?
As conscientious as I can possibly be.
Okay, and you feel you feel misrepresented in the media somehow?
Oh, grotesquely. I feel as though $1, one vote leaves me standing in the rain when it comes to my responsibility as a citizen to vote.
So you would like to be lifted up as a kind of citizen hero because you're not part of the consumer bandwagon?
Although that would do my superego some good. No, no, I don't think so. I think what I would prefer is a national movement toward living simply, toward less consumerism and more productivity, more contribution.
As a way of filling citizenship, as a way of...
Absolutely.
But David, Ardell, I'm sorry, you know that politicians and economists often respond in horror to that notion.
Oh,
and stop buying and everything falls apart.
It makes me a little sad to think that I, being a constituent of those people who respond in such horror, don't get represented.
Mm-hmm. Ardell, we've got it. Thank you for your call. Elizabeth Cohen, is there, I guess, David, Ardell, sorry, Ardell, Ardell raises in a roundabout way, an effective way, but a question that came to me. Okay, it's the consumer republic you describe it, and it's partly laudatory and partly dismissive, but as opposed to what? In the world we live in today, what's the alternative vision?
Well, you know, I do talk about a politics that was made possible by the consumer's republic, the consumer movement. And there have been sort of three over the 20th century. There was a sort of one in the progressive era. There was a consumer movement in the 1930s. But the most important and powerful, influential one was really in the 1960s and 1970s. We associate it with Ralph Nader.
But it's still about consumption. I won't buy a Pinto. It's make my Pinto safe.
Yes, it's true. And I think that the alternative, the sort of small... world,
simple life
kind of thing that caller's talking about. You know, we know from this analysis, I think, why that doesn't hold a lot of influence, because so much of the health of our economy is seen to be dependent on people spending.
But are you also then saying to Ardell, get over it? We are a consumer nation and we will be, and that's just it.
No, I mean, I think that there's a lot to the choices that he has made, but I guess as an historian, I recognize why that's not the reigning sort of philosophy. But I do think that in between where Ardell is and the sort of this sort of more dangerous sort of view that we're talking about is this possibility for people to mobilize as citizen consumers, and to use that position to sort of make claims on corporations, on the government, and really try to hold them to higher moral standards. I think we're seeing that in the SUV struggle that's going on right now. You know, we're seeing the two views. The citizen consumer who's feels that consumers should be responsible citizens, that they shouldn't be buying gas-guzzling cars, they and so forth. And then the consumer, the SUV owner response, which is, I have rights as a consumer, that my citizen rights are at stake here.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Here's the new sun coming up, Liz Cohen describes. It's citizenship, it's political, but it's still based in consumerism.
Yes, I think she's probably right that that's a historic change. There's no going back. But it has to do also with the pursuit of happiness. There's something pretty basic about it. But, you know, what strikes me is there are so many the things that we can't buy individually and can only buy collectively, though that is being neglected. And, you know, we can't immunize ourselves from disease. We can't really secure educational opportunity all by ourselves. It's only when we begin to make collective provision for needs that no one of us can satisfy that's when we, in other words, it's the public consumption that we need desperately today, insurance for people who don't have it, decent environmental protection, things that that individual consumer, if he worked night and day for the rest of his life, could not afford. And yet, because we define everything in terms of that consumer, we're missing what Galbraith called the social balance, the public sector, to offset the private sector.
Liz Cohen, that's a good point. You raised this issue of Bill Clinton. You say, he, the great Democrat of the 1990s, transformed what you call the consumer's republic into what you call the consumerization of the republic. What's the difference with the Democrat there?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that Jack said. And my notion of the consumerization of the republic is something that we've been living with, I think, in the last two decades, and it's becoming increasingly intense.
What is it?
And that is the sort of application of the consumer relationship between buyer and seller to the citizen's relationship to government, so that you start to ask, as this sort of process goes on, what am I getting my money's worth? How is my relationship to government rewarding me? And what happens is just what
which
Jack
now
was,
sounds like a wholly reasonable question in our current
culture.
Yeah,
that's because we've bought into this, and it
is it wrong?
It goes back to Jack's point that, you know, when you start holding individual sort of benefits up as the test of the viability of government. And asking whether I'm getting my money's worth, you lose totally any sense of the larger good.
But collective benefits also deliver, collective assets deliver individual benefits. Does consumerism somehow lead to losing sight of that?
Yeah, exactly.
Why?
Well, I mean, there's so many ways that it plays out. But, for example, if, you know, it's when we think about education, which is a common good, the way that we deliver education to people in this society now is based on where you live, on the wealth of your community, on the property tax base of that community, on the money that's generated in taxes to pay for those schools, and so forth, so that has become very market-directed, market-driven.
Right at the heart of things. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Muhammad's calling from Boston. Hi, Muhammad. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
My point is actually about this consumerism. I personally feel that for an American, being a consumer is almost part of the culture. And what I mean by that, and I don't want to be making any sweeping assertions about Americans in general, but
go ahead, Muhammad. We can take it.
But I tend to think that personally, I'm not an American, obviously. And
where are you from, Muhammad?
I hail from Morocco.
All right. So give us your sweeping generalization. We're looking for big perspective tonight.
Okay. What I think is, I would actually think twice before buying anything. And what I mean by anything, of course, I don't mean, you know, staples, things that are in the house, like milk, sugar,
okay,
and stuff
right,
like that.
Right.
But I would buy things, you know, considering, you know, if my overall budget allows it. My wife, on the other hand, who happens to be American,
okay,
I feel that she feels as an easy prey to these elaborate marketing and advertising techniques. And like I was telling you, screener earlier, that almost every time there's a problem that pauses itself at home, and we're debating whether we should, what are we going to do about something, her answer is always, let's buy something.
Welcome to the roller derby, Muhammad. I mean, yeah. your complaint sounds like a 1950s American husband complaining about his wife. I don't think it's unique to you being Moroccan and she being American.
Well, it almost seems like a purchase is an answer to her problems, and it shouldn't be that way, though.
We've got the point, and it's a good one. Thanks for your call, Muhammad. Liz, is consumption then the great distraction from politics? Is it the distraction from some kind of more fundamental citizenship?
Well, I was actually struck by, you know, the Muhammad's point that this is so basic to American culture. And actually, that was a point that was made in the heyday of the Cold War, that Americans...
With pride.
Absolutely. That was the difference between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Our system delivers.
Yeah, we could. In fact, you know, when Nixon was arguing with Khrushchev in Moscow at the American exhibition, he said, you know, actually, America's more of a classless society, you know, using sort of Marxian sort of ideals than the Soviet Union.
You know, we can laugh at that today, but that's a big deal. If you've lived in a country where you can't even afford a bicycle, to live in a country where you can consume, that where a system produces goods for the people, that is a positive good.
And as Mohammed is saying, you know, that you could actually solve your problems by buying something, you know, that you could make choices in the marketplace, that was a way of expressing your freedom.
You write, you talk about Christopher Lash and Michael Sandel urging this disjoining of the two categories, citizen and consumer. And that we need to get back to an ascendant or a vision that's more about self-governing and it's more morally, religious, committed, civic, republican, true citizens. Can we be that again?
Well, I think not. I mean, part of me would love to see us be a very different kind of society where people viewed themselves as they were proud to be taxpayers and proud to participate, to be contributing to the common good, and not seeing our economy driven by, you know, purchasing power and so on. But I don't think that's realistic.
Is all lost, or this is okay?
No,
this is just a new strain of American democracy.
I mean, because as I've been trying to, you know, talk about that there are these sort of these tensions and these different strains. And I think that my best hope is that we will build off of the positive citizen-consumer legacy and see that, you know, as consumers, we have some way of, you know, making demands on government and saying that, you know, the goods we have need to be better distributed, that we want to make sure that the things we buy are safe, that the government plays an important role in regulating the economy and regulating goods, that we not be afraid of what only government can do.
Elizabeth Cohen, it's been just great talking with you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. Elizabeth Cohen is professor of American Studies at Harvard University and author of the new book, A Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Post-War America. Jack Beatty, sounds like it may be the thousand-year reign of the consumer republic here.
It does. And Elizabeth's point about how we have assimilated, we don't have any model anymore for what the founders called Republican virtue. It's all, we look at politics, how does this going to affect me? What's in it for me?
What in it for me? But you end up wondering if Mother Nature may not end up being the great arbiter here. I mean,
that's such a good point.
I mean, consumption must have a limit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in conflict with the biosphere, ultimately, with all this junk.
Well,
sorry, American consumer goods.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Okay, bye.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.